Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Bewitching Book Tours Blog Talk Radio. I am D.L. Ross, your host. Today's guest is author James Hunter. We're here to interview him about his series, A Yancey Lazarus Novel. This is episode 2, Cold Hearted. We're also going to talk about the rest of the books in the series today. Welcome, James.
Hey, thank you so much for having me on. It's good to be here.
Absolutely. It's our pleasure. Now, from what I understand, you are talking to us from Colorado. Kind of tell us about your home, your state, your family, what you like to do out there.
Yeah, I have 2 kids. I have a 3-year-old and a 6-month-old, and we just recently moved back to Colorado from Thailand. We've been here for about 6 months, but this is where I grew up originally, is in Colorado. We're in the Aurora area. It's awesome here. I mean, everyone's moving to Colorado for good reason because it's beautiful and amazing, and we have great weather and mountains and camping and skiing and about everything you could want to do, except that it's really expensive to live here. But and if you can afford it, this is a place to be. So, yeah, I like spending time with my family. When I'm not riding, I go to the gym and do some church work, and that's kind of me.
Well, it sounds like you lead a very busy life, and I can only imagine when you have a toddler and a baby that keeps you extremely busy.
Yes, that is an accurate assessment of the situation. Very busy with a toddler and a baby. It's true.
Yes. Well, now you mentioned your church work, and then you mentioned being in Thailand. Are those associated?
Yeah, so I do some outreach work here, but I hold a bachelor's in theology, and I did some mission work overseas in Thailand with my wife. We did church planning and international aid work over in Bangkok for a couple of years, and then we came back here for family health issues. But I still continue to do that. Religion and mythology and all of that stuff are kind of passions of mine, and I think that shows up in my work also. I mean, it kind of bleeds over. But yeah, that's a big part of what I do as well.
I think that's outstanding. You know, when I was reading and researching about you, I noticed in, I believe it was in your author bio, that you mentioned now that you are a stay-at-home dad. After you mentioned that baby and a toddler, how do you like that transition? Are you still being a stay-at-home dad, or did you run for the hills?
No, I'm still a stay-at-home dad, and, you know, it's a blessing. You know, I really feel privileged to be able to get to spend time with my kids, and, you know, we've been really fortunate that my writing has done well enough that, you know, that's been kind of our income staple, and so it's allowed me to work from home and to make my own hours and to do what I love, which is to write, to have time to go out and serve the community, but to also be present with my family, and that's, like, a really cool thing. Like, not a lot of people get to do what they love and also do it with their family and have family days and, you know, be there for their kids and to be present for everything. So I feel really extraordinarily blessed to be able to just be with my family and have that experience, which I think a lot of dads don't get. So yeah, I'm not running for the hills. This is exactly where I want to be.
Well, I think that's wonderful. I do agree. I think you're very blessed because it's always a blessing when you get to spend time with your family, but also when you get to spend time with your family and have a career that allows you to be at home and do what you absolutely love doing, that is definitely a blessing. Well, since you're talking about your writing and that the fact that that's where your passion lies is being able to stay at home and spend time with the family and write, let's talk about this outstanding series, Yancey Lazarus novel. Tell us about the series, what it's about, and then if you wouldn't mind, since we're going to be talking about episode 2, but let's go ahead and talk about episode 1 also. Kind of give us a breakdown of episode 1, 2, and 3, and let us know what's going on in the series.
Yeah, sure. So the books are adult urban fantasy. When I say adult, I don't mean like paranormal romance or like senior romance. None of that. That's not really what I do. More so that it caters to an adult audience. But they're urban fantasy. They're kind of action-oriented books. A lot of shoot 'em up, explosion, fart joke. You know, it's kind of juvenile humor. I'm not writing high literary fiction here. The main character, Yancey Lazarus, is kind of this old timer. He's in his mid 60s, but he's a mage, which is kind of like a wizard. He lives longer, so he doesn't, you know, he's still moving like a young guy, but he has kind of this older mindset. He used to be sort of a wet works guy doing dirty jobs for the Guild of the Staff, which is sort of this supernatural council that polices dangerous things that come into that come to Earth from other realms and stuff. And but now he's just kind of an itinerant homeless person living out of the back of his car, and he just kind of travels around. He likes drinking beer and eating ribs, and he's kind of a musician by trade. That's what he really loves to do. He likes to play guitar and play piano. He really loves the blues, so he kind of travels from bar to bar, and he kind of plays for beer money, and he likes to gamble, and that's sort of the life that he wants for himself. But he has all of these former enemies from sort of his old life, and he just tries as he might to kind of keep his head down and just, you know, stay under the radar and do the things that he loves. He always ends up sort of getting dragged back into the politics of the supernatural and ending up dealing with the fallout from all of the things that he's done throughout his, you know, 60-something years.
Wow. Where on earth do you get your ideas?
Well, you know, I get them from a lot of different places. I read really widely, and everything that you read kind of makes an impression and leaves an image in your head, and I think that culminates in your writing. But a lot of it's mythology. I really like I said, I have a degree in theology, and one of the things that I've always been really passionate about is exploring world religion, and I really like digging into like really obscure mythologies, Eastern mythologies or Native American mythologies, and finding really wild stories that probably most people in America have never heard, and then finding ways to sort of splash those against the contemporary backdrop. So I really enjoy doing that, and I think it kind of, like I said, again, my books are not high literary fiction, but they're fun, and there's a lot of wild things in there that probably a lot of readers have not seen before.
Well, no, when you talk about the ancient mythology and all, is that where you get your idea for your creature, Fae? Is that how you say it, Fae?
Yeah, so there are Fae creatures. A lot of that comes from more Irish mythology in the fairies, and kind of the high court of the Tuatha De Danann and all the Irish gods and goddesses. I mean, Yancey has kind of some old enemies in the Irish court of gods and goddesses that make reoccurring appearances, but there's a lot of, in the universe of my novels, you know, like werewolves and vampires, those types of things exist, but I don't really give them much screen time. I like to spend more time focusing on, like, the lychee, which are, like, tree spirits that inhabit Eastern mythology, or Rakshasa, which are, like, these kind of weird shape-shifting ghoul monsters that are Indian demons from the Indian subcontinent. So I like to pull from some of those sources as well.
I'm amazed. I mean, I write romance, but I can't even imagine trying to create these shapeshifters and all these different mythological creatures. I'm amazed with the creativity of authors such as yourself. I just think it's outstanding. When I noticed when I was reading about the book and everything that you talk about a fix-it man. Okay, now when you say fix-it man to a single woman, I think handyman. Somehow, I don't think that's what you have in mind.
it does come across that way. But that is what he does. That's kind of his unofficial title was sort of, he goes in and he fixes problems. He is a handyman in a sense, but the things that he's fixing are not necessarily broken pipes or your sprinkler system. He's cleaning up and doing the dirty work that kind of nobody else wants to do, mostly by shooting those things or making them explode in spectacular ways. So that's kind of how he fixes things. But, yeah, that's sort of his former life and his former job.
Well, now, what is the Guild of the Staff?
Okay, so that's sort of the supernatural ruling body that kind of governs mages in the world and kind of it's not something they don't really have a laws. I mean, laws in the way that you would think of maybe a government, but rather it's an organization that's sort of dedicated to protecting their own members. It's sort of it's like a union, strength in numbers. There's all these kind of really awful creatures that exist in the world that sort of prey and hunt on humans, and so they kind of have this ideology that, like, hey, together we are stronger than we are apart. So it's kind of this group of folks who are banding together, these mages that are banding together to prevent them from being murdered horribly, sort of. So that's kind of where they fit in.
Okay. So now in episode 2, Yancey Lazarus is basically called in to try and rescue a child that's been kidnapped. Is that correct?
Yeah, he's minding his own business. He's, you know, in the bars playing the blues, and then a friend of his from back when he was working with the guild reaches out to him. He says, hey, this thing took my grandson. Can you come help me get him back? And because he's a sucker and he doesn't know how to say no, he says, oh, fine, okay, I guess I'll go do this thing. And he ends up getting pulled into this thing. He only goes in initially to save this kid from this kind of decrepit old fey creature who's kidnapped him, but he stumbles upon this huge plot that has these undertones to sort of unravel the guild and shift the balance of supernatural powers. There's a whole bunch of sort of courts and supernatural nations, and so he kind of uncovers this giant plot that's trying to tip everything over and sort of throw the world into anarchy. And he reluctantly sort of gets roped into trying to figure out what's going on and how he can solve it.
Wow. Okay. So now, I know when Yancey is out looking for this child, he has to partner with an FBI agent. But this isn't just like a friendly FBI agent. This is somebody who's been after Yancey, true?
Yeah, that's correct. So, sometimes I think when I read other urban fantasy novels, I mean, how can these people go and blow things up and kill all these monsters and not have, not make the FBI's most wanted list? Well, he does, and that's one of the things is during the course of his fix-it years, he ended up, killing some people who, if you knew about the supernatural community, okay, I can understand why that's happening, but the FBI is not clued into that, and so he makes the FBI's most wanted list, and they've been hunting him for a while, and it sort of ends up catching up with him, and he ends up having to pair with this FBI agent who's been hunting him for 4 years, trying to bring him in to close a case of sort of unsolved mysteries that Yancey has been involved in.
Okay, so now this is all from episode 2, but now episode 3 is available right now also, because 1, 2, and 3
That's
are
correct.
Out right now. Okay, now what, without, ruining it for the readers, what kind of happens between books 2 to books 3? I mean, how does the story progress?
Yeah, that's a great question. Each novel is a standalone novel, so you could pick any book up in the series read it from the beginning to the end, and it's going to be its own self-contained standalone story, but there is a sort of overall series arc as well. So the second episode, Yancey is dealing with this decrepit old creature who is actually Old Man Winter. He's the deposed king of winter. And episode 3, he's continuing to follow sort of the trail of the trying to find who it is that's sort of doing this unbalancing act and who's subverting the guild and who's infiltrating these other nations in order to sort of bring them all down and topple the system. And so he's continuing to follow those leads, and they lead him to a new case involving a Bigfoot, which is weird. It whenever I say it out loud, it sounds ridiculous, but like in the book, it's great. So he ends up pairing with this sort of Native American Bigfoot guy, and he's fighting against a crazy cannibalistic Sasquatch that's called the Wendigo, and there's a lot of wonkiness and shenanigans that ensue, but it's a great story. It's probably the best of the series, book 3, and is definitely worth checking out.
I'm just sitting here in total amazement when you sit here and talk about all these creatures. Have you always, as a little boy, were you into the supernatural?
Yeah, I think that's always, something that's always been really appealing to me is just the idea that there's more to the world than what necessarily meets the eye. And, I'm not necessarily a believer that all of these things really exist in the world, but I think the idea that there is some element that exists beyond just merely the physical, what we can see, what we can experience, is important to me. And so being able to write a book or a series of books that incorporates that idea and explores the idea that maybe there's more that's going on beneath the eye, and being able to explore that in a really concrete way has always been really appealing to me.
Well, now, is there an episode 4 that's going to be coming out?
Yes, I'm really excited. I'm getting ready to release episode 4 mid-September. So that one's called Savage Prophet, and it's going to kind of continue on with the series, and there's a lot of wonkiness in that one, too. There's Haitian voodoo and zombies and weird Naga are a type of Thai mythological serpent deity, and so he's going to get to spend some time in Thailand, and he's going to go to Haiti, and there's going to be a lot of new and interesting things to see and then murder. So I'm really excited for that release.
Oh, sounds incredible. I mean, I don't know if our listeners know, but I do, just because I get to, you know, get the background on you. But I have a feeling that part of your ideas in some of the places you travel have to tie in with the fact that you were a combat veteran and are a Marine. First, thank you for your service. And then second, kind of tell us about your time as a Marine and overseas and in combat and how that kind of ties in with your stories.
Yeah, absolutely. So Yancey is also a Marine. That's one of the things that we share in common. He's from a different generation, obviously, than I am. He is with the 3rd Battalion, 3rd Marines. I served with predominantly through most of my career with the 13th Marine Expeditionary Unit. And I served from 2005 to 2009. I left as a sergeant, and I went on 3 combat deployments. One of them, the first one in 2007, I spent time over in Al Anbar, Iraq, as a convoy machine gunner. After that, I went to Jordan to work with the 13th Marine Expeditionary Unit to train the Jordanian Royal Marine Corps. And after that, I deployed in 2008-2009 on a Westpac, and we spent time in Djibouti and off the coast of Africa doing pirate hunting operations as part of a task force called CFT-151. Then after that, I decided to get out and be with my family and do something else. But a lot of those experiences certainly find their way into Yancey's narrative and Yancey's story. I mean, a lot of the experiences that he has had during his time serving in Vietnam or during his time in the Marine Corps were certainly shaped by my own experiences. And a lot of the traveling that I did in the Marine Corps and after the Marine Corps have also managed to work their way into his stories.
Okay, you said pirate hunter. Okay, you've got to explain and tell us about some of these adventures.
Well, you know, it sounds a lot cooler than it actually is. A lot of it was just, you know, being on ship or we spent time in Camp Lemonnier, which is in Djibouti, and we did some time working with the French Foreign Legion. Mostly, it was the Navy patrolling, and we were there, you know, as backup in case that anything happened. I was on the USS Boxer when Captain Phillips was taken, and so our unit was in Djibouti when he was captured by Somali pirates, and then we were recalled to the ship and met up with the Navy SEALs, who eventually ended up killing the Somali pirates and recovering Captain Phillips. So that was, we were there, you know, during those events, but you know, a lot of it was just, you know, sleeping on ship and going to the gym and eating chow. It's much more exciting on paper than it was living through. And I think that's kind of been my experience with the Marine Corps in general. It's about, you know, 5% cool stories and adventure and 95% boring, miserable, awful experiences where you sleep in terrible places and you eat terrible food. So, you know, it's kind of 5% thrills and 95% boring.
Well, I was going to ask you, if you had to choose 3 words to describe being a combat veteran, what 3 words would come to mind?
I'd have a tough time with 3 words, but I think that
is definitely
possible, but boring is a big part of it too, and just uncertain. You know, I think that all of those things kind of coming together. Sure. I mean, I remember when I was in Iraq, we'd do these just crazy convoys, and I was up in the turret as a machine gunner, and a big part of our job was to look for IEDs, improvised explosive devices on the side of the road, but you know, there's just trash everywhere, and an IED could be anything. It could be
right.
You know, concealed in a dead goat. It could be concealed in a tire. It could be underneath a pile of trash. You're just constantly looking, and you know, you can go days and days and days and weeks where you're just on the road looking for something that's never there, and then suddenly it is. So it's huge stretches of just miserable, boring heat or cold, and just interrupted occasionally by just terrifying events.
Like I said, I appreciate your service and your family's allowing you to go over there and do that for us. That I think all of you are just outstanding. When I've always heard that from the guys that I've talked to who have served overseas, that there's such a brotherhood that you make lifelong friends. So when you tie your stories into your real life stories, is Lazarus, does he have friends, or is he just kind of a standalone, be his own man guy?
He is kind of a lone wolfer in the sense that he, you know, he likes to go and he likes to travel and he likes to do his own thing and he likes his independence. But he has a network of close friends, and several of them are not supernatural anyway. A lot of them are his Marine Corps buddies. One guy in particular, Greg Chandler, who's partly based off some friends that I have in the Marine Corps. He's sort of a culmination of all of these people, but is sort of his closest friend and confidant, and they served together in Vietnam. And that's you're right. I mean, there's a camaraderie, especially for guys who have gone and served in any kind of combat environment together. But it's just, boy, you really can't shake that. I still have a lot of really close friends who I don't see very often because we live in different parts of the country, but we talk regularly. Sure. And you know, those are still really important relationships to me that I value very highly.
Of course. Absolutely. They're only ones who can truly understand what you've experienced. When you're writing a book, how long does it typically take you to write, like, say, one of these Lazarus novels?
I've gotten faster the more that I write, the more streamlined it becomes. I think that with my first novel, it took me quite a long time because, you know, you're learning the ropes. You don't know what works. You
Absolutely.
Don't know what doesn't work. You don't really have a readership, so you don't have any good feedback on, hey, this was awful, don't do that anymore. Or, this was really wonderful, I really liked more of that. But I think after I released that first book and I started to get some reader feedback and I found an audience, and they started telling me, hey, we like this, we don't like this, this is what we want to see more of, that really helped inform the process. And now the more that I do it, the more comfortable I get doing it. And so I can probably write a book in 4 months. And they're fairly long, usually over 100,000 words. 110,000 words is kind of a normal length for one of these novels, and I can usually do that in about 4 months. And that includes, you know, I outline it in the beginning, and then I write through a first draft, I do several drafts after that, and then I turn it over to early readers to give me feedback and look for plot holes or character development things or other things that I might have missed before I turn it over to my editor and then release it.
Well, now, how many books have you written?
Currently, I've written 4 full-length novels, and then I've written 2 novellas that are each about 30,000 words.
Okay.
And then I obviously have another book that I've written, and I'm planning to release in September, so I guess that would be my 5th full-length book.
Okay. What are your other series? Obviously, not everything's a Yancey Lazarus novel.
Yeah, I have one other book, which is the first in the series that I plan on continuing to write. It's called Mudman, and it takes place, it's an adult urban fantasy novel, and it takes place in the same universe as the Lazarus series, but it's very different in tone. Lazarus is sort of, it's funny, it's sort of upbeat. I mean, there's some dark humor in there, but it's first person, and it's really fast-paced, and it's different. Mudman, although it takes place in the same universe, is a little bit darker. There's some darker themes. It's written in third person, and it stars, instead of Yancey Lazarus, it stars a guy named Levi Adams, who is this really socially awkward, shape-shifting golem, who was created by Jewish rabbis during World War II to murder Nazis. But, you know, the war ended, and he is still around, and he still sort of has this compulsion to murder things, but he's sort of become self-aware over the years, and now he's working on not murdering things so much. So that's kind of his backstory, and he's working with the, he's wrestling with thoughts of what does it mean to be human, because he's not really, what does it mean to have a conscience, what does it mean to do the right thing when I've been specifically created to do wrong things, and then just trying to work that out as he takes the weirdness of life as being a human, or existing in the human world, but also existing in this sort of supernatural community.
Well, I have to tell you, I love your covers. And for the listeners out there, if you have not seen James's covers, you have got to go to Amazon, or be it Barnes & Noble or wherever you like to buy your books, and check out the covers, plus, you know, check out the books. But who does your covers, and do you have input? Do you help them with the creative ideas?
Yeah, so Mudman was done by Lou Harper, who is a wonderful cover artist, and I really enjoyed working with her, and I plan to work with her some more in the future. The other books in the Lazarus series were done by a guy named Dane, who works at ebooklaunch.com, and he was really a joy to work with. He's very professional and turned out really great products, very timely and efficiently. In terms of the creative process, I mean, they put the cover artist obviously put a lot of that together. But in terms of the overall layout and the concepts and the pictures, a lot of that is stuff that I do. I spend a whole lot of time going and scouring different photo sites, looking for background images that I think really pop or really capture the book, character figures, and then they, being the wonderful artists that they are, take those ideas and take those photos that I've suggested and find a way to ram them together in super awesome ways.
Oh, and awesome is the correct word. They are outstanding.
Well, thank you. I love them.
I mean, they're definite eye catchers. Well, I'm going to kind of switch topics here, but when I was reading on your author bio again, and I keep mentioning it because, listeners, you have to go out there and read his author bio. Talk about an eye catcher. You caught my attention reading all the exciting things you've done, but what is the Royal Order of Shellback?
So yeah, that's it is in my bio. You are absolutely right. It's sort of a joke thing that I put in there, although it is a real thing. So the Royal Order of the Shellback is a Navy tradition, actually. And even though I wasn't in the Navy, I was in the Marine Corps. I spent a lot of time on naval ships during the course of my deployments, and so the Royal Order of the Shellback dates back to the early 1800s, and it was a tradition that when a sailor crossed the equator for the first time on a ship, they were initiated into the Royal Order of the Shellback. So uninitiates are called polywogs, and then when you cross over the equator, there's this big ceremony. The captain of the ship, it's really hard to explain unless you've experienced it, but the captain of the ship and his senior-most officers, they dress up as Davy Jones and Poseidon and a whole bunch of other Greek gods of the sea, and they hold court, and they judge you, and you have to go through a series of tests, and really it's like a big party, and there's, like, weird songs and, like, kind of, like, weird sea hazing. It's a really strange thing. And it lasts for about a day and a half. It's really weird, but it lasts for about a day and a half. And if you manage to endure all of these weird trials that the court orders you to go through, they award you the title of Shellback, and you are adopted into the family, and you become a son or a daughter of Neptune. And then they have a giant party, usually with beer and barbecue. And
that's
the thing that happens for most folks. And then if you cross over again and you are a shellback, you get to be part of Davy Jones's court, and you get to be the ones to initiate the polywogs who are coming across for the first time.
That's great. Well, we're about to run out of time, but I want to tell the readers to go out and grab these first three episodes that are available now. You're on your Bewitching Book Tours tour through August 22nd. If they go over to your website, I'm sure, and your social media sites, they'll be able to follow along. And then, of course, in September, they want to be prepared, have read the others to grab number four. Quickly tell us your website and your social media sites before we run out of time here.
Sure. Thank you for having me on. And you guys can find me at jamesahunter.wordpress.com. That's my blog. You can find me on Twitter, just writer James A. Hunter, or I'm on Twitter. I think it's JamesHunter13 at Twitter. So you can find me any of those places or look me up on Amazon. And thank you again for having me on.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.